And welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Grapp. Well, it's the Science Forum today. Our panel of great minds is here, ready for your toughest scientific questions. We'll meet the panel in a moment. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, you can join the conversation by emailing us. It's voxpop at wamc.org. You could hit our Vox Pop page of the website. It's wamc.org/voxpop. And you can make some comments or questions there. You could tweet us if you wish at WAMCVoxPop. You can comment on our Facebook Vox Pop post, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You know, again, I said this yesterday, it's a call-in show, so if you'd like to call, that would be great as well. 800-348-2551. It's the old-fashioned way, but it works quite well. 1-800-348-2551. It is the Science Forum, and let's meet our panel of scientists. Sign in, please.
Nancy Slack. I'm an ecologist related to the Sage Colleges, although I'm just back from working on Mount Washington, where I must say the climbing is tougher than the science.
And recovering from a athletic-related injury as well.
Well, that's over with.
Okay, good. All right, good. You're feeling well. And next?
Ken Wells. I'm a physicist, retired from the General Electric Research Center.
And how is retirement treating you?
It is fantastic.
Really?
I am enjoying it
now
tremendously.
You're speaking to a radio person who will never be allowed to retire. So it's nice to hear that someone can. And?
I'm Andrea Worthington. I'm a professor of biology at Siena College. And having a great summer studying dragonflies.
Oh, and what have you learned?
Well, it's been a wet summer, so we've been trying to, we've built our rig, we took it down, built it again. It's like, so we're, it's a, been more of a technical problem solving, but it's been lots of fun.
The number
so we're
call.
Working on vision and prey capture and how they use their eyes to look at small dots in space.
The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Dragonflies scare the daylights out of my children. They look terrifying, but they're not dangerous, are they?
No. Anything with a mouth can bite, you know, but it's like they're not going to run off and bite you. They're looking for flies, Drosophila.
Do you look
gnats.
At the earlier stages in the water, too?
Yeah. When I'm during the school year with my research students, I'm usually working with larvae because it's easier to raise them in the lab, and you can get them and hold on to them all winter.
Oh, I had a six-year-old at our neighbor's pond looking for them this morning.
Did they find any?
No, but they found a frog and three tadpoles.
How many species are there of dragonflies in this area at this time of year?
Oh,
not exact, mind you. Ballpark.
Maybe 100.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, if you include the damselflies and all of that, and
yeah.
All the different kinds of habitats they're in. Lakes, ponds, rivers, you know, the woodland streams, you know, there's a lot of them out there.
And where are you doing your research at this time?
Well, we do mostly a lab-based neurophysiology at Union College, but we collect our dragonflies for our work all at any little small pond in the area. We go to Anley Pond, Steinmetz Park, we go up into the Adirondacks, go into Glens Falls. Go anywhere we can find them with a net.
Very interesting.
There's
indeed.
Very good little guidebook with colored photos for amateurs who want to look at dragonflies and find out what they are. They're beautiful.
There are quite a few out, yeah.
They are beautiful. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. And Ken, what's interesting you in your retirement?
I'm having a tremendous time reading and listening to books. I'd never had the time before I retired. And I just right now I'm in the middle of a James Lee Burke book that is just fantastic. His latest that came out 2 days ago.
So do you read and then supplement with the cassettes or CDs or do you read the whole thing?
Well, I frequently will listen to the whole thing, and that's nice because if you're not doing anything that requires verbal skills, you can listen and work at the same time. So I do a lot of work on in the backyard. Lumbering and backhoeing and that sort of thing, and listening to books.
Fantastic. And Nancy, you're working on your latest book, eh?
Yeah, I'm working on a new edition about the New England Alpine. It's going to be bigger and better with beautiful photographs. But I'm mostly working on Mount Washington on a climate change project.
And what have you learned anything new that you can share with us at this time?
Well, we found a lot of rare species, and we're trying to actually do a baseline study so that people can come back 5 and 10 years later and see what changes there are with global warming or other changes in climate.
Interesting. Great. Interesting. 1-800-348-2551. To the phones we go on this Vox Pop Science Forum. And Merle and Argyle, you're first.
All right, I'm first. The question I have is, if you lose 80% of your body heat from your head, why would you want to wear a big brimmed hat in the summertime?
Well, you don't lose 80% of your body heat through your head. That's a very popular misconception. There are certain circumstances where you do, and that's what the original study actually worked on. This is in Arctic conditions where people have their body totally bundled up in heavy clothing, but they have to leave some of their face and head open in order to see what they're doing, where they're going. In those conditions, yes, you will lose maybe 80% of the body heat out through the hat. But in the summer, I lose most of it, I would guess, my arms and my back by sweat evaporation.
Right. And I wear
a hat because it makes a tremendous difference in the temperature my face feels and whether I get wrinkles on my face or not.
And it's stylish, of course.
Oh, not my hats.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And also, it protects from UV radiation, too.
Absolutely.
And the face is exposed year-round to sunlight. And so in the summertime, when it's the highest intensity of sun, longer hours of sunlight, you would wear a hat, too.
A light-colored hat probably is better.
Yeah, reflective. To protect yourself from UV.
All right, Merle, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551, the Science Forum. And let's go to Tony in North Adams. Tony, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling because there's a big science issue going on right now, namely climate change. And there's been a big sort of disinformation campaign that has made it so that we're all significantly behind the eight ball in terms of getting ahead of climate change. And I'm wondering what you as scientists think we can do to help you promote the science of climate change so that we can actually start to do something about this before it's too late. And I'm actually saying this because I got a 4.5-year-old son. And I think we got a lot of work to do, but a lot of people are not even starting yet, including our leaders.
Okay. Panel?
Well, maybe we can all say something about this. I could just say that I just came back from a big meeting in London. There was no air conditioning in our meeting rooms, and it was 90 degrees inside and outside. And I started my talk by saying, I guess all Londoners do believe in climate change, even if no all Americans don't as yet. But, you know, we've had so many things going on this year. You know, in the last year, between drought and storms and all sorts of happenings to the climate, that it is surprising that nobody's taking notice. Drought, apparently, people have taken notice about.
Ken?
Well, I'd have to take, as a real scientist, or not that you're not, but as a scientist on this position, I have to say that you can't take 1 year as indicative of climate change, or 2 years.
I agree with you.
The accepted standard is a 30-year trend. And it's difficult, but you can see over the last 30 years, we've had significant changes, especially at the poles. We're discovering a tremendous number of things that are happening to our climate. It's to people with a good science background, it is almost indisputable. Unfortunately, it's not a popular notion to say climate is changing, we have to change our lifestyle. And people don't want to hear the change your lifestyle message because most of the changes are difficult or expensive or both. And people like to hear a more popular viewpoint that people try to cast doubt on climate change and say it's not happening, the scientists are all trying to fool us. But unfortunately, I feel like our generation and the generation before have doomed my grandchildren to some real serious issues. Yeah. I don't know how to spread this more accurately in a world that's as divided, in a region that's as divided as the United States seems to be on this issue. So I would like to know an answer to your question also.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you've got you can say, well, should it be on a big scale, like on a government scale or an industry scale? But a lot of it has to happen on a very personal scale, like not driving your car as much and taking more public transportation so there's less CO2. And there's lots of small things that we do for our comfort that we'll have to stop doing when it gets to be really where it's a serious
will it be too late
thing.
By then?
Oh, yeah. What's happening in the Arctic and Antarctic is saying Earth will continue. Whether humans will be comfortable, it's not clear.
All right, that's a good spot to take a break. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. It is Vox Pop. It is the Science Forum. More calls coming up.
Support comes from Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York, featuring a variety of David Austin roses and an assortment of perennials, annuals, trees, and shrubs. Monday through Sunday, 8 to 5, a gardener's destination. StoriesNursery.com. Paradise Copies, Northampton, Massachusetts, providing printing design for customers for over 20 years. From digital to offset, color copies, scans, logos, and more. ParadiseCopies.com. Kingsway Community, Schenectady, offering a continuum of care and services to area seniors since 1975, including rehabilitation and more. Caring in the family tradition, KingswayCommunity.com. Mario's True Value Home Center, Valencia, New York, two locally owned locations, open 7 days a week for building supplies, equipment rentals, and hardware needs. Featuring Ben Moore Paints and Stains, MariosTrueValue.com. And the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond. 518-580-8080.
Science Forum on WAMC Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551, the number to call. Andrea Worthington here, Ken Wells and Nancy Slack. I'm Ray Graff, your host, and back to the phones we go. Angela in Amherst. Angela, you're on. Hello?
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
So I'm really interested in the topic of dragonflies. Before then, I think that it's, your discussion is so important. I think we have so little personal accountability when it comes to our own personal contribution to global warming and to climate change, et cetera. And, we've just become, as in the United States, so wasteful, so entitled, and, just so accustomed to having everything ready-made and disposable. But I was so fascinated by the short discussion on dragonflies. Because I happen to live in an area where every summer we looked forward to seeing the huge amount of dragonflies that would come into the yard that would dragonflies were just sort of a part of summer. Mm-hmm. And I was recently in Maine and in Algonquin, and where we had also had the same experience with seeing a lot of dragonflies during the summer. And We've seen very, very few in the area this year.
My
children are particularly fascinated because there's so much mythology and legends from South America that talk about dragonflies being sort of the window to the other world and being able to sort of navigate by the stars. So I'm curious to know I know so little about dragonflies, and I'm wondering, how they relate to, or what you're seeing in terms of climate change and Earth degradation, as compared to something like, the bees that we're all familiar with, and how is it significant? What do dragonflies do other than be, sort of fanciful and fly around the?
Okay. Good.
Well, two things. First of all, I've totally noticed that there hasn't been a lot of dragonflies this year because we need to find them. And part of it, I think, has been just this year, which could be related to climate change. The amount of rain we've had made it so that a lot of animals that were spending the winter as larvae and emerging from their ponds and lakes and rivers, and that first few weeks when they emerge, they have to eat a lot of insects. And if it's pouring rain, they can't. And so there's been a lot of rain. And so I think that we've had a smaller population this year because they've died. If they emerged as young adult dragonflies and didn't get anything to eat, they can't come back. They have no energy. They've probably starved and not able to come back to the ponds and fields and stuff like that for mating and feeding and continuing. So the pond we have in our backyard, we've seen just now, this part of the summer, the dragonfly population is rising, and usually we have tons earlier. But that's just, we have had a rainy, very rainy spring and summer. And
if we had a normal year next year, would it bounce back to a regular population?
Right, as long as one animal can lay a lot of eggs. And
okay.
So that if one animal is successful and lays eggs, then there'll be a lot of offspring next
okay.
year. Yeah. But in terms
of... Do they die over the winter? Or do they
the larvae
do in the winter, and what is it that they do?
Okay,
so they the adults that are flying now are feeding and mating, and they're laying their eggs in the ponds. These eggs are hatching into aquatic larvae, and they stay as aquatic larvae over the winter time, and they will many emerge after one winter. Out of the ponds. There, if you're farther north, it may take 2 years of growth in the water before they emerge. If you're really far north, like in the Arctic, it could take 15 years before the larvae of one year come out as adults. The only one later in this summer, there'll be the very large green darner is going to be emerging. The ones that emerge late summer are going to fly to Florida. With the hawks.
Wow.
And they will go, at least in our area, and then their offspring emerge from Florida and fly north with the hawks in the spring.
Why do they fly with the hawks?
Well, it's just that's because that's the time to migrate.
Oh, I see.
They're not flying. That's the time
they're
of year.
They're not getting a ride.
They're not
getting a ride
okay.
with them.
I understand.
That's the time of year that they do their migration.
So individual adults migrate all the way
to Florida.
Florida.
Wow.
Back.
Amazing.
Yes.
Wow.
Angela, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Tim in Guilderland. Tim, you're on the Vox Pop Science Forum.
Hi. A question for Ken Wells. We have the best physicists, the best technicians, the best scientists, the best engineers in the world. How can we not find a way to stabilize and store nuclear waste, stabilize and store spent nuclear rods, and resolve this problem?
Well, okay, first I'll take issue with you. There are a lot of good physicists other places than the U.S. We have very good physicists. We know exactly what we have to do in order to stabilize nuclear waste or dispose of nuclear waste. But right now it's an economic issue. It would take a tremendous amount of money to find a way to put it in a place where it's safe for not just decades, but centuries.
And what would that place be?
The place we would have to find something that is geologically stable. We used to think, you know, there are all sorts of things that we find out are wrong. So the storage area in Nevada
mm-hmm.
that we looked at, they found that it wasn't as dry as they expected. You could take all the nuclear waste and you could basically turn it into glass by diluting it in sand, heating it up, and making it totally a glass-like substance, which would wear away so slowly that it would be stable over an enormous number of years. But that process is so economically expensive, not likely. We're looking at new reactors, that such as the thorium breeder reactors, that can take spent nuclear fuel, reuse it, and at the same time as reusing it, turn it into much less dangerous and less long-lived byproducts.
Wow.
But there are a lot of things that we're doing that we believe will make a difference. But right now, it's a lot more economical to just sort of store it and hope that next year or the year after that, it's going to be cheaper to take care of it.
Wow.
Okay.
And that's what they're doing.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. The Science Forum. Andrea Worthington, Ken Wells, and Nancy Slack here. And Ray Graff, your host. Daryl in Johnstown is up. Daryl.
Yep, back on Dragonfly.
Well, all right.
Wow.
I'm not in the city of Johnstown. I'm up in the foothills, and I have wetlands near me.
Okay.
And I have plenty of plenty of dragonflies.
No, it's gotten
all
better.
Kinds of species, mm-hmm. and I never run out, believe me.
Great.
Yeah, I'm not having any problems at all, and I see no slack whatsoever.
So what kind of wetlands do you have? Do you have the running water, still water?
Well, I'm on a hill, but I'm on a double hill, so, you know, anything, any rains or anything like that accumulate, seep through, down through. And I have marsh areas where
mm-hmm.
a lot of birds live and stuff like that and take baths and things like that and a lot of frogs and stuff in there. And there's a lot of dragonfly larvae in there.
Great.
Well, I got a couple of questions for you,
sure.
But I wanted to just give you a little experience. It might bore some of the people out there, but I have put myself purposely in the path of flying dragonflies mm-hmm. at times. You know, they do take back and forth paths at times.
Okay.
And I've held my finger up in that path, and after a while, you'll find, and don't think it's that rare, but a dragonfly will land on your finger.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
you
yeah.
become a landing zone.
If you're still enough, sure.
Yeah,
I've
never been bitten by one, although I think they could if they wanted to because they have mandibles, but they're not interested in us.
No.
And one of the things I found, you know, a doctor will put his finger out and say, follow with your eyes, checking your eyes. I have done that with a dragonfly. I've put my finger very close to it, not up to it, to frighten it, and very slowly. And then I've moved my finger left and right. And what I discovered is I thought their eyes were fixed. They're not.
No,
they
no.
followed my finger back
head.
And forth.
Oh, interesting.
Head,
yeah.
The head follows the finger. Yeah, that's one of the projects we're working on is what nerves drive that, what
yeah.
feedback there is.
What kind of eyes do dragonflies have?
They're compound eyes.
Compound eyes.
Yeah. And they've got these
very
big
visible.
Bubbles of, you know, faceted eyes. And, yeah, the head is very flexible, and that's what
yeah.
they're using to peer and look at things.
I think they have a lot more intelligence than we think, too. It might be something you'd look into. Two questions, though. I have a pair that keep landing on my porch that I found are beautiful. Their abdomens are a powder blue,
mm-hmm.
and their wings are an opaque black in parts and clear in others.
Mm-hmm. Pachydiplex, probably. That's a small. It's about
is there any
2.5 inches long.
How much?
2.5 inches long.
Yes.
Yeah, Pachydiplex.
Pachydiplex
is the Latin name. That's the genus. I don't know its common name. Sorry.
I was going to say, that's a beautiful one. I'm surprised it doesn't have a... Maybe I'll come up with
Well, that's
one.
A great idea. How about Daryl?
Daryl Plitex.
Yeah, there you go.
And one more question for you. In your studies, has there been any aerodynamic studies as far as copying it for airplanes? Because some of the aerodynamics that I've seen with those double wings have been incredible, and these creatures are very fast.
Now, there's people in Australia, there's people at Harvard that are looking at wing aerodynamics, and Air Force is giving them funding for that, MIT.
MIT has a robotics lab, and they have created a model that flies using the same wing
wow.
motions, and
mm-hmm.
it is just very impressive
Howard
to
Hughes
see.
Institute. There's a lot of people looking at this.
Yeah.
So these will be drones then, presumably,
exactly.
at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robots.
Wow. Yeah, there
and
you
they'll
go.
Be very fast if they use that same tactics. Well, thank you, folks.
Hey, Daryl, thank you for the call. Very interesting call.
They actually have different behaviors, too, because I had a student at Sage who was studying behaviors at Rensselaerville, and she had names, you know, Joe and Jim and all that for all of her dragonflies, and
oh,
she
that's
could
so,
tell
great.
Them all apart, even if they were the same species.
I've frequently found if I'm driving on my tractor, my backhoe, that when a dragonfly gets close, it becomes fixed relative to the tractor. Tractor's bouncing all around, but if you look, the dragonfly will stay like 3 inches above and 1 inch to the left of the center line of the tractor. He moves around so fast that every motion of the tractor is completely mimicked, and he looks totally stationary relative to the tractor. Now, is that a behavior for getting prey, or...
Well, they have to stabilize their eyes to get prey. They're so sure.
Oh.
So if they're looking at, you know, when they're...
So they stabilize to relative to whatever they're focused on.
Right.
Interesting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Neat.
Very neat. 1-800-348-2551. The Science Forum. It's funny how these shows will take on their own character. And now it's dragonflies. Let's go to the phones. And, oh, gee, I wonder what this is going to be about. Chuck in West Springfield, you're on.
About dragonflies.
Yes. All right.
We all seem
well,
to like them.
It's sort of a combination of science and fantasy. My wife has a fantasy of having a hat that attracts dragonflies, and her fantasy of that is that the dragonflies, is our understanding, eat mosquitoes.
Yes.
So So I was just wondering about how many dragonflies would it take to clear a, you know, a half acre of mosquitoes, or is it viable because they both breed in open water?
Well, you know, people would take dragonfly larvae put them into ponds and lakes, harvest them somewhere else, and put them for mosquito control because they're eating the wrigglers. The larvae are aquatic, and they'll eat the larval mosquitoes.
Oh.
And yes, the adults are great at catching the mosquitoes too, but they're not going to be at the same voracious. Well, they're pretty voracious, but they're not predictable. You can't herd flying dragonflies, but put a bunch of larvae in a pond and you've taken care, can reduce the amount of. In fact, we have a pond in our backyard that we deliberately use to raise dragonfly larvae. We don't allow any fish in it or anything else that would eat the larvae themselves, and we have no wrigglers in our pond, no mosquito wrigglers in our pond. And it's like, because they are voracious.
If you wanted to make a hat that attracted mosquitoes.
Okay, the hat thing, yes.
Yeah, what would you put on the hat?
Well, mosquitoes, right?
You can't believe that just yesterday my husband and I were at a pond with polka dots and black and white plaid things, because we had heard this thing that if you had plaid on, that the animals would think the dots were insects and they would come at you. And just yesterday, we were at a pond with we went to Joanne's Fabrics, bought every dotted fabric they had there, and had them lying on the shores of the lake, trying to see if this would actually work to bring them in.
And?
It didn't.
But
they weren't that many animals out that day, so I would say that the fairy folk tales that they come to checks or dots, it's probably true, just there weren't that many animals out the day we tried it.
Interesting.
So try checks and dots.
Okay.
All right, Chuck, good luck with that.
Great. Thank you.
We had one from, via email here, Callie in New Paltz. I love dragonflies, kind of my totem animal. Wondering if the awful decline of bats, I love them too, has affected dragonfly population. It seems there are more dragonflies now, or am I imagining it? Callie in New Paltz.
Dragonflies fly in the daytime, bats fly at night, so there's not necessarily a predator-prey thing going on here. So I'm not sure. I think that the dragonflies are more variable regarding sunshine, warmth, the state of ponds, the health of ponds. I don't think that it has to do with bats at all.
I was thinking about your ecosystem function of the dragonflies and eating insects, and it seems to me that the demise of bats, which doesn't have to do with climate change, is probably much more important, in fact, in terms of controlling insect populations.
Yes. Yeah.
1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Bonnie in Sharon, Connecticut is up. Bonnie.
I have dragonflies.
Great.
they're attracted to aged, weathered cedar decking.
Oh, okay.
Maybe got a nice pattern there.
So you get a cedar hat and you're good to go.
There you go.
Yeah.
I was calling with regards to what I consider to be a building attempt to debunk global weather changes. And I bring to your attention, if you don't already aware of it, a book written by Michael Crichton called State of Fear.
Oh, yes.
I've gotten two-thirds of the way through, and utilizing real data, he is trying to build up an argument that the concerns about global weather changes are bogus. And he's doing it, of course, in his usually creative, exciting format. But he is a well-read and well-circulated author, so I find that disquieting. I don't believe he's alive anymore, but I'm not sure. In any case, I also came across today on YouTube a video that had just recently been put up, which, again, is a set up very scientifically, but comes off being very super paranoid about what's really going on, and the implication being that it's all because of solar flares.
I see. Do you have a question for the panel?
Well, I'm asking, the people on this panel are all scientists in various specialities.
Well,
what are they or their colleagues doing to counteract this in a, how can I best say it, a better, a more coordinated way? Because I see this stuff coming out of the woodwork left, right, and center, and people I thought were, you know, how shall I say, thinking straight, opening their mouths and coming out with things that are like, you have got to be kidding
me. Panel. All right, that's fair enough. What do you have to say before we hit our break?
Well, if you have a political agenda, you can pick your facts or your perhaps not really facts as you wish. And I think that's a big problem with some so-called science writers. You know, you can answer these questions one by one, but unless you're going to write a popular book, Ken, I don't know.
I think that I would identify on what Bonnie said about organizing an attempt. Scientists aren't organized.
I've noticed that.
Scientists just are very independent people, and unless they're collaborating on one paper or something, it's difficult to get them to all organize and make one thrust uniformly. They do independent research. That is what they're trained for, and so that makes it difficult. The people you want to look to are popular scientists.
Yep.
Neil deGrasse is great at this.
Okay. Well, then maybe he should be writing the book.
He's a great spokesperson for science.
I think Scientific American, I get Discover Magazine, I read the New York Times Science section every Tuesday, and I zero in on anything science.
All right.
But I'm frustrated.
Can I make a comment?
Nancy's going to make a comment then. Unfortunately, we have to take a break, Bonnie. But
okay.
Go ahead, Nancy.
My comment is only that very few people actually do that. You're one of the well-informed people. There are many others. And I think that the glaciers melting and the temperature changing so the plants are dying, it doesn't really affect people as much in their daily lives as the things that Andrea was talking about. So
it's Vox Pop on WAMC. It's a science forum, and we will be back with the home stretch coming up.
Support comes from Adams Ferriker Farms, Poughkeepsie, Kingston, Newburgh, and Wappinger. Local summer fruits and vegetables, Hereford beef, local imported cheeses, specialty groceries, and more. AdamsFarms.com. Dr. Joseph Cohen, optometrist, eye examination, classic eyewear, contact lens fitting in historic uptown Kingston, participating with MVP, Empire, Davis, VSP, Medicare, and other insurances. CohenOptometry.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. CollegeStreetMotors.com. And Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, legal and consulting services on regulatory issues for life insurance and annuity manufacturers and distributors. CurrentCompliance.com.
Science Forum on WAMC Vox Pop, 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. And our guests, Andrea Worthington, Ken Wells, and Nancy Slack here. And we have a couple from, I guess it's email, I'm not sure, could be the Facebook. But here's one to our panel. Howdy. I believe the science and facts regarding climate change, but how much of it is it because of the planet's natural cycles versus human use of fossil fuels? That's from John.
Well, the level of CO2 in the station in Hawaii has been rising, along with historical levels of gas use, petroleum use, you know, combustion. It varied, but not that much.
Right. If you look at history of the weather for the time that we know it, and that's maybe the last 200 years that it's been recorded fairly accurately, maybe 250, what you see before the beginning of the 20th century is variation. What you see since then is variation with an accelerating trend of warming.
Right.
So there's a tremendous amount of variation. It's difficult to say what percent is caused by humans. Well, we may have added a little to the variation, but we're probably doing almost all of that trend line, that slope up. There have been no natural occurrences that we know of you get an occasional thing like a big volcano will happen, and we'll have global cooling for a year or 2 years while the ash gets out of the upper atmosphere. These sorts of things happen occasionally. That's a natural process. But the trends, all the trends are being drawn by us.
All right. And let's see. This is from Brendan. I'm not sure where Brendan is writing from. It says, quick expository topic, if possible. Wondering if you might ask the scientists as a panel about the problems they think we might solve with modern biotechnology and biogenetic engineering, and what they each think is the single biggest next advance in biotechnology and or engineering. A huge question, time running out. Let's move quickly.
One of the biggest things biotechnology could do for us is to come up with a really fast-growing algae that yields an oil that we could use as a diesel fuel.
Fabulous. That's a great idea. And I think some of the things they might be doing with putting micronutrients into food for people who don't have that available to them in the soil, like the golden rice and that sort of thing, is pretty cool.
I think medical biotechnology is coming along in terms of actually sending chemotherapy to exactly the right places instead of just all over the body and causing damage.
Okay, and thank you for checking in via the social media and whatnot. Let's go to Alan in Catskill. Alan, you're on.
Yes, a question for you. Whether global warming is real or not, population is going up. If one does not address population issues, whatever conservation gains are made get chewed up by increase in population. Very few of the articles, what have you, dealing with climate change even mention population.
I agree with you completely about that on the long term. But on the other hand, populations are going down in most of the places in the world, highly advanced societies so-called, that are actually causing most of the trouble in terms of using...
That short term.
Yes, short term, I think it's a big problem there. Long term, if the population keeps going up and more people are using all these resources, all this gasoline, you're absolutely right. And it has not been well addressed. I agree.
All right, Alan, thanks a lot. Let's go to Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on the Vox Pop Science Forum.
Yes, hello. This is a question I had last time, and I haven't heard anybody say that they did their homework. But
okay.
I was, last time I asked, and again I asked, how is it that the very high voltage transmission lines, we're talking about the ones maybe that were coming from Canada down to New York City, the underground lines, and the one that I know they have one out on the West Coast that's proposed, that are running on DC instead of AC because of the line loss. Now, I thought we had the science...
Yes, but we Ken was not here last time, and I bet you this is right in his wheelhouse. Why don't you pose this question briefly once again, Mark, and I'll bet you get a satisfactory answer.
Okay, well, basically, the very largest power lines, the highest voltage power lines that are being contemplated or being built or that are being built are all being using
direct current.
Direct current.
Yep.
And from my physics experience, which was quite considerable in college, I took 4 years of it, I always thought that AC was the way that we would transmit long distances.
AC, let me give you a quick historical perspective. It's if you transmit power at high voltage, it means low current. It means you don't lose as much. Therefore, you always want to use high voltage when you're going long distances.
Right.
Okay. Now, high voltage used to be very hard to get in DC and very easy to get in AC. You just build a transformer. You can't build a DC transformer. You can build an AC transformer. Okay? Now, recently, within the past decade or so, we've come up with much better ways to make very high voltage DC. We've come up with the semiconductors required to work with it. Therefore, it's now becoming feasible and economically viable to use DC. In addition, in the future, when we have superconducting power lines, you can send a lot more power as DC over superconducting power lines than you can over AC.
Well, that part I understand.
Okay, so that's the reason why the really high voltage lines, where it's really economical, that they use DC.
So how do they step it down?
They step it down by actually taking that super high voltage DC and turning it into super high voltage AC and running it through a magnetic transformer and in a step down transformer.
Uh-huh. Now, you have your answer, Mark. It only took you a month and a half, but well done. Thanks a lot, buddy. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Jerry in Schenectady. Jerry.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to respond to Ken Wells' question before about how to make the case for climate change more successfully.
Go ahead.
First of all, I think we need climatologists speaking directly to the average person, like in terms of public service announcements or paid advertisements. A lot of times they'll speak to fellow scientists, or they'll have open sessions where people can attend, but normally only people who are interested in the subject will go to attend, and that's a small percentage of people. And the idea of popular scientists, as was mentioned before, is a good idea.
Okay, you got any questions for the group?
Well, no, but he did ask the question, so that's why I'm asking.
Okay,
I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
But I have a scientific reason, too.
All right.
When the range of temperatures that humans experience over the course of a whole year can be over 100 degrees, when scientists talk about the globe warming by a couple of degrees over the span of a number of years, a lot of people just don't think that's much and worth getting all excited over. And I think the same about sea levels rising. They talk about several inches over a period of years.
When a tide is many feet.
In a day.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Great point. Last week the macadam on the roads out of London were melting in the heat, and I think people did really notice that as well as their own discomfort without any air conditioning.
Let's go to Vicki in Albany. Vicki, you're on.
Hello. I've been interested in reading about the God particle.
Yes.
And I'd like to know, I understand briefly that it gives the all elements, all elemental particles, mass, which becomes matter. I'm not sure if I've got that right, but I'd like a simple book to read, something that would explain it simply, I should say.
Okay.
And can you explain this to me? And also, when was the God particle, when it became part of our attention?
The Higgs boson has been something that we thought existed for quite a while, and I don't know whether it's a decade or five decades, but it's been hypothesized for a while. People have looked at the table of elementary particles and said, look, in this corner here, there's something, and I think it's a boson, and I think, as opposed to a fermion, and I think it's important, but we had to have an enormous amount of energy to create one and test it. So we've just recently gotten the superconducting ring that accelerated it, and
has it been confirmed now?
It has been confirmed to, I think, 3.5 or 4 sigma, and we really want to get it to 5 sigma. That's shorthand. The scientists say we need to see a few more of them before we believe it's real and have a really good, accurate feel for what it is.
Okay, is there a book, a simple book that
I don't know of one.
Okay.
Oh, PhD Comics. Go look on the web at PhD Comics. They had this wonderful, they've got people that it's they're comics, and they put out little panels of research, and there's a number of them on particle physics of people who are doing PhDs in Switzerland.
PhD Comics.
PhD Comics.
Right. Well, there you go,
yeah.
Vicki.
Looking it up on the web.
One more question. So. What can you name some of the elemental, the elements that it brings together?
Okay.
That it gives mass to?
Yes.
Well, there's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, berzium, ruthenium, uranium.
Yeah. Okay.
All of them.
All of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Vicki, thanks a lot. So it's PhD Comics.
PhD Comics.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you very much. Let's go to Michael in Cummington. How are you?
Good. I was hoping I could ask a question about hornets.
Sure.
And wasps.
Yes.
I'm presently taking down a structure and have come across numerous wasp nests, the kind of wasps that have these two long legs that trail behind them.
Yep.
And they are very docile. They will come at me occasionally and buzz around me, and I've even swatted a couple with my hands, and they don't come back. Hornets, though, are a completely different situation. You cannot negotiate with hornets. They are incredibly hostile, and you can't even get close to a nest. So my question is, what is genetically different? What causes the hornets to be so much more aggressive and these wasps to be so docile? Now, the wasp nests are small. The biggest one I've seen is maybe about 4 inches in diameter, circle. But the hornet's nest, I had one on the side of my house, was like a football. Right. But yeah. I'm sure there are different species of both.
Well, I mean, I'm sure they're trying to defend their nests. And if you've got all, if you've laid all your eggs in one basket, you're going to defend that basket. Whereas wasps with their smaller nests, well, you destroy that. They can go off and lay a few more eggs. You know, it's like
it's genetically determined behavior. For different species, and wasps and hornets can be quite different species. We have the same experience with wasp nests, which we have in our house. Even when they manage to get in the house, they don't bother anybody.
Definitely genetics. I'm saying that the species has this pattern of reproduction and this way of producing more of themselves, and they're
more aggressive
to defend
it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, Michael, thank you very much. Let's get to Lynn in Shelburne Falls. Lynn, you're up.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I'm on global warming now, and the cicadas. I'm in Massachusetts, and I've seen pictures of the cicadas. I know it's an insect thing. I don't know. Can you answer it? There's so many insects in Connecticut, and we have got really no 17-year cicadas up here I can distinguish from anything else.
No. I mean, the whole cycle that was being talked about, I don't think it got any higher than the Hudson. Hudson, New York. And I looked on the web at the maps, and then hypothetically they're up here, but they did not come as far north as the maps were predicting.
Interesting. And do you have any speculations on weather change in New England? I know it's a tough one.
You know, I've had some people that I've talked to have said that the whole Northeast is going to stay a green jewel, and as opposed to places in the West and maybe places in the South, and that we're going to, if, you know, all the stories come true about drought and fire and flooding and all the rest of it, that we're going to become pretty overpopulated in hundreds of years from now.
We're going to be the last place left that's good.
Oh, interesting.
That's what I've heard. That way too. The way
called us the green jewel.
Maybe my house value will finally go up.
And it has a lot to do with the fact that we have moderate water hydrology. We have the same amount of rain. Global, you know, we get very steady water input month by month in this area. And we've got woodlands and we've got grasslands and all this stuff.
Got lots of trees.
And lots of trees.
All right, Lynn, thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You know, the 17-year cicada is fascinating. Had none around here that I noticed. I had to take my daughter down to an event in Woodstock around there.
Yeah.
Got out of the car, and it was deafening.
Really?
Yeah. It's totally cool.
Unbelievable. Now, would that have anything to do with less dragonflies than
No. Not attached to dragonflies.
Not in any way.
It's amazing emergence all at the same time.
Yeah.
The fact that they take 17 years between runs, it blows my mind because cicadas are out there every year, right?
And there's 13 and 15-year cycles, too, out there. So it's like there's different populations moving through different cycles.
Well, we are just about out of time. Thanks to everybody who called in, and thanks to our guests, Andrea Worthington, Ken Wells, and Nancy Slack. Support for WAMC comes from The Alternative Baker, Rosendale, artisan all-butter baked goods made from scratch, handcrafted lemon velvet cakes and egg sandwiches daily, where taste is everything, lemoncakes.com. Wiawaka, Lake George, New York, an enrichment and revitalization historic lakefront retreat created by and for women since 1903, WIAWAKA.org for events. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, women-owned and operated with a combined 70 years experience. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. And Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock, New York. Local seasonal organic produce, vegetarian and vegan hot dogs and burgers, natural skin care, sunscreen, and bug spray, sunflowernatural.com. Thanks to everybody who joined in today, either over the internet or on the phones. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who was at the controls. Hannah Hohenstein-Flack answered the phones today. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Moyers and Company at this time. And then on Monday, it's a Medical Monday. Alan Chartok is your host. He'll talk hypertension. It has been now confirmed that Alan is actually a leading cause of hypertension. And no, that's a typo. Thanks for being here, and we'll see you next time.